So today is the 4th of March, 2016. We're here for another interview with Dr. Martin Karplus at Harvard University. I'm David Cruz, and I'm here with Roger Eardley Pryor. As we mentioned, we're going to pick up where we left off last time. We had been speaking about your time at Harvard. I'm not sure if we necessarily got into a lot of detail about why you chose the California Institute of Technology, but I think that might be a good place to start to...
I'd actually like to step back for the last class you had at Harvard. Was that Woods Hole seminar in the summer.
Right.
What are some of your memories of that experience?
Well, it was, I was really in the physiology course, which was a course mainly for graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, and I was the only youngster in the course, and so that was sort of special. And well, I made a number of friendships there with Alex Rich and Jack Strominger that lasted sort of for a lifetime. And, well, Strominger is still alive. Alex died recently. And it was, for me, it was sort of, I don't know, it was very special. Also, the way I was able to go there was that I'd been working with George Wald, and he recommended me, and Wald recommended you, then you got. And also there were these, it was a standard thing that people, between the seminar and other times, there was a lot of free time. And so one of the traditions was to go to the beach, and all these famous people would be there on the beach, and St. Georgie was there, and Otto Levy was there, and I got to know them. I was pretty, I guess George Wald would introduce me, and one of the things I discovered was that Otto Loewi, now if I can, I'll see whether I can really remember the details, but I think he did studies of the heart and its how the heart responded to stimuli, and discovered that basically by isolating it, the nervous system, that the hormonal, the hormones that were affecting the heart. And I realized that actually what he did was exactly the same thing as my grandfather did in Vienna in the 1900s, when he discovered that the function of the hypothalamus, and found out that by doing essentially the same thing as Loewi did much later, by taking cats, cutting all the nervous impulses that could come from the hypothalamus, and one of the things was controlled all kinds of, can't think of the word right at the moment, responses that were not, there is a word for it where the response, it's not something that you do consciously, but anyway, I can't think of the word. But anyway, so he found out, he isolated it and watched the cat's pupils closing when he stimulated it, and he reasoned that there was some sort of fluid which was actually transmitting the information. And it's now realized that the hypothalamus is the only part of the brain that basically has endocrine cells, just like in other parts of the body, that release hormones. And so at the time that I met Loewi and talked with him, I wasn't aware actually of the details of what my grandfather had done, and my paternal grandfather, but so there were lots of things like that. Also, the social life was very active down there, and it was a lot of fun. And did some experiments. I mean, people in the course did various experiments, and I did experiments on photoreactivation of trying to in bugs to that to photo that were sensitive to light, and they didn't really. I mean, nothing really very exciting came out of it, but. It was one of the times I decided, well, I wasn't really an experimentalist. And the other thing also was, of course, that I was already very much involved in cooking. And there were all these squid and lobster and all these other wonderful things were hardly used. I mean, they took the giant axon out of the squid, and then the squid was left over. So. Every evening, I would go around and collect all these things, and then make a stew or something for my friends. And so it was, I was sort of being away from my parents, really, because when I went to Harvard, I lived at Harvard, but it still wasn't the same thing. So I think it was very much a formative experience. And then actually, when I went to Caltech. I roomed with Alex Rich for the first year, which I guess we should get into later on.
Mm-hmm. At Woods Hole, this is late 40s, early 50s, around 1950, and this is as
47
even,
yeah.
That early. So the United States
no,
is...
No, sorry, with 1950.
The United States is moving closer and closer into this Cold War confrontation with the Soviet Union. Was politics an issue of discussion on these beaches in the summertime between scientists?
Not that I remember. It was much more on science and new ideas and exchanging ideas and such.
Were there any, do you recall any responses to the development and use of atomic weapons, the potential for... I mean, the government had such a major role in the development of atomic weapons. It took in a lot of scientists. A lot of scientists participated in it. After the war, you start seeing scientists reject the use of such weaponry. Mm-hmm. So even if there wasn't a discussion of the politics of the Cold War, were scientists or were the people that you were talking with speaking of thinking about the potential of their research for being used in governmental ways or anything along those lines? And
no, I mean, I think George Wald was involved in some activities, wondering about atomic weapons and such, and what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
With the decision to go to Caltech, you knew you wanted to be on the West Coast. Why?
I thought it would be good for me to, I couldn't imagine being in the middle of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was the choice of being on the East Coast and following sort of in my brother's footsteps, or being on the West Coast. And the two institutions that attracted me were Caltech and Berkeley. And I had to decide which one. I mean, I applied to both of them and got into both of them, and then had to decide where I wanted to go. And there again is the story, which I presume is in there, that my brother was at the Institute of Advanced Studies, and I visited him there one day, and met he was working for Oppenheimer, and who was at that time a professor at both Caltech and Berkeley. And I asked him, about what would be the best place to go. And we talked about, that Berkeley was a huge institution, while Caltech was a much more intimate institution. He didn't know that much about the chemistry. He didn't know Linus Pauling. And he made this remark, which was that Caltech was a shining light in a sea of darkness. And so So talking with him and then also with my brother, I decided, well, I would really like to go to Caltech. And
what did that mean, a shining light in a sea of darkness? Just
well, the Pasadena area, in contrast to Berkeley,
okay.
was a very reactionary area, and there was nothing to do there.
Mm-hmm.
And while Caltech was really an outstanding institution.
Okay.
How did you get across to California?
My parents had given me a car, and I drove out there, and I made a number of trips back and forth, starting with going through Canada, and the last trip I would come back in the summer, usually for visiting them, and then the last one being through the south of the U.S. with various experiences that happened there.
Well, we'd like to hear about some of the experiences. I mean, you know, you had come to this country at a relatively young age, but you had been situated principally in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious to know why you were trying different routes and what it is that you experienced on those routes that kind of stood out, either about... Yeah, you mentioned you were in Canada, so the differences between American culture and Canadian culture at the time, or, you know, were you stopping, were you sightseeing along the way? Did you wind up going on Route 66 at some point? I'm just curious to know a bit more about some of the adventures you had on the road going back and forth between the
mm-hmm.
East and West Coast.
Well, going through Canada, I really didn't... other than the nature, I mean, basically, I went across and then stopped in the national parks up there and rode around on horses and such. And it was really mainly admiring nature. I don't remember whether we talked about when I went to the Gaspé Peninsula earlier. I was very much interested in birds
mm-hmm.
also. And one of the things I persuaded my parents to go up to the Gaspé Peninsula, where there was a big rock. You couldn't go to it, it was protected, but where there were various alcids and guillemots and such that nested there. And so, but I bring it up now because I remember there driving through the countryside in Canada to get there and seeing that there were these towns, relatively small towns with local agriculture and other things, and the one big building of the Catholic Church or Protestant Church, but it was sort of, I still have this memory of driving through and first thing you saw was this huge church. I had the feeling people were relatively poor, but somehow they managed to have a big church. But in this trip through Canada, I would sleep in the car or somewhere. And that trip, was all by myself. Some of the other trips, I had people with me, and I was mainly enjoying nature and bird watching. Those were the two main things in that northern route. And then the other route that I mainly remember is the one that was most in the deep south.
Mm-hmm.
Route 66 appears later. Let me just think. A second. So I'm just trying to situate the time
mm-hmm.
when I graduated in 53, Well, let me talk anyway about the southern trip, and I will get back to the other one. There we drove through the deep south, and there was with a friend, Erwin Oppenheim, and we drove along, and it was very hot, and we decided we'd take a swim to cool off. And we passed an area where there were lots and lots of people. Then we went further along the river, and saw there was a completely empty area, but it still had sort of a dock, and it was available swimming, and nobody was there, so we went swimming there. And after we'd been there a relatively short time, all of a sudden this truck comes up, and several people jump out of it, and they're all carrying guns, and we had no idea what was going on, but they said, well, you know, this is the area reserved for niggers, which was the word they use, and, you know, what are you doing here? Are you northern agitators or something? And it took us a long time to persuade them that, you know, what we were doing was just what we were doing, and so they finally let us go. But we, of course, were deathly frightened. We didn't know what would happen. We had read about lynchings and all that sort of thing, and so that was one experience that I certainly remember. And,
what was the reason that you wanted to go through the Deep South? Was it just to see a different part of the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, basically this was an opportunity to see different areas of the U.S. And
were there any landmarks that you wanted to visit along the way, or any specific routes, or was it just let's go through the South and then make
our
way?
In the South, there wasn't that much. We went through Las Vegas and spent a little bit of time there. We never decided, well, we could lose, I don't know, $10 or something, which in those days, you know, was not negligible, and you could play for half a day or something like that if you were conservative. And I mean, landmarks that I visited more were, you know, sort of in the middle when I visited Rice and Zion and such. And
What did you do at these parks? You mentioned going to Banff and Jasper and Rice and Zion down in Utah. So when you go to a park, what's your typical experience there?
Well, so obviously the variable. It's we, depending what it was, would camp for several days and walk around, horses around, and you know, they are so beautiful and spectacular. And then, you know, birding was always in the background, and I knew what birds one might be able to see, you know, that were very rare on the East Coast, and so I was looking for some of the birds. Don't ask me the names. But it was that sort of an experience. And yeah, I mean, it was when I graduated and my parents gave me a Leica that my uncle had brought over from Germany, and but I went on Route 66. But I had graduated, and there, you know, I took all these photographs, which ended up in at a Navajo festival. Just by accident, you know, I was driving there and visited some of the Hopi Pueblos, and also it was in Navajo country, and as I said, they had, I guess it was their annual festival, which was just a festival for them, I mean, where they had, you know, a Ferris wheel and shooting gallery and all these things, and there were only Navajos, and I don't know, I have some beautiful photographs of them. And I was the only non-Navajo there, and so took lots of pictures. I mean, I didn't really talk very much with the people, but they saw me taking photographs. Often they didn't know that I was photographing them, but something else. And that was really a great experience. Nowadays, this annual Navajo festival, you know, has 10,000 tourists who come there, and they're really performing, you know, rather than having, you know, their own experiences where they also were trading and such. But,
what are your memories when you came to California that first time, coming into the valley, the L.A. Basin?
I remember when I came to the L.A. Basin. You know, I drove from Canada south along the coast, you know, which again was very spectacular.
Down
and
from Big Sur.
Route 101, which is the coastal route. And remember on the way, you know, finding a place that had abalones, which were a great introduction to them and such. But when I ended up in the basin, what I remember is the smog. And you know, it was really terrible in those days. And basically, you know, I had a very bad headache and for several days. You know, I just couldn't do anything. Then you sort of adapt to it, and you know, still remember that, you know, from Pasadena, from Caltech, the mountain range there, and every afternoon it would disappear. I mean, the fog was so thick. I mean, nowadays it's always much, much better when there's all the control, emission control and such. But that was really my first impression of the area.
Mm-hmm. Did you regret not going to Berkeley?
I'm not sure. I'm not a person to regret things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm always sort of moving forward, which is, my wife describes it, that I don't have enough feeling about, well, you know, what's happened and such.
So at Caltech, your interest initially was biology, in the biology department.
Right.
And you were going to work with Max DeBrew.
Right.
Tell us about that experience.
Well, you know, I decided, although at Harvard I majored in chemistry and physics, and I majored in that because I had decided that if you wanted to understand, I may have said this before, but if you wanted to understand biology, you really had to know chemistry and physics. So I was already directed in toward this. And so I decided, well, it was about time to start doing some biology. And Max Delbert, you know, who was a physicist who had become a biologist and basically was one of the people that put phage genetics on the map with Luria at MIT and other people. And, there is the story, I don't know if it's true, that when he was a young physicist and working for Niels Bohr, Bohr told him, well, you know, you really should go into another field. And biology might be an interesting one to work at. I don't know whether that's apocryphal, but it's certainly, yeah. And so, you know, I decided to work for Max, as everybody called him, and was in the biology department at Caltech. And one of the things that Delbert did at the time, I didn't know that he did it to everybody, but it was sort of a rite of passage, was that he had you give a seminar. And so I was going to give a seminar about vision and the work I'd done on that.
With George Wald.
With George Wald, right. And of course, Delbert did not know very much chemistry, but I don't think that was really the problem. But sort of, I started my lecture. Of course, I was nervous, and Delbert after a couple of minutes said, I don't understand, he meant not that, he really didn't understand or whatever, but that I wasn't being very clear in my explanation. And this went on for, 15, 20 minutes or so. And I was getting more and more upset. And I had hardly gotten beyond my introduction because of all these questions from Delbrook. Nobody else asked any questions. He was sitting in the back of the room. And I had gotten to know Richard Feynman. I'd taken his course, and then he used to come up to our house and play the bongo drums when we had parties and such. And I'd invited him because, he was interested in everything. It was clear from this lecture book that appeared, the Feynman lectures. And he was also in the room listening. And so at a certain stage, Delbrook was in one seat in the back, and Feynman was maybe three seats away. It was a relatively small room. And Feynman all of a sudden whispered, but so everybody could hear, "I can understand what he said, Max." And at this point, Delbrook got very red in the face and rushed out of the room. That was the end of my seminar. But then he called, I think he said, you come to my office, and he rushed out and come out and said, and then he told me, there's no way we can work together, you'll have to find somebody else. And so I went to George Beadle, who was the head of the department, and talked with him, and we talked about various things, but I finally decided, I would go back to chemistry, maybe because I felt safer there, and decided to work for Kirkwood, who was doing some biologically, that wasn't his main interest, but he was doing some biologically related things about electrolytes and proteins and such, and I started to work on that.
So at Caltech, nowadays when I think about the way the graduate school works, you apply to a department, you're accepted into that department, and that's where you're going to work. Was it as simple as just going and asking to work with someone else who wasn't in the, or was Kirkwood also situated in the biology department?
No, he was in chemistry. He was one of the outstanding people in statistical mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
In chemistry, it was Ansager at Yale, and then Kirkwood, who was probably sort of next in the hierarchy. And I went to see Kirkwood and asked him, and he looked at my record and such, and he said, "Okay." I mean, there wasn't any sort of formality of changing from one department to another.
Okay,
and. Here at Harvard, there is a graduate student who's very bright and wants to do some work with me, but I don't really want to take on a graduate student because of my travels and everything else officially. And so he's been trying to find other mentors in theory. And one thing I said is, you should look also at applied physics and physics as well as chemistry. And he looked into it and he said, "There's no problem." I mean, he would still get his degree probably in chemistry, but he would work with somebody in these other areas, which is a little bit different from my case that I actually switched to biology. But it was basically Kirkwood said, "Okay," and that was it after.
That original worst seminar for Max, where he left red in the face, what was the topic that you were trying to explore?
Well, I was talking about vision, a mechanism. I had invented a mechanism for vision which wasn't really known in detail, but partly based on the experiments of Wald and his wife Ruth Hubbard, who was really the more chemically educated person. And the, you know, it's a, another one of these stories that, you know, he was a professor, and then for many, many years she was just a senior research associate, which permits you to stay at Harvard. There are not very many at Harvard. Harvard doesn't have people more now than then who are not part of the teaching faculty. But they had a few research associates, senior research associates, which were sort of tenure positions. And it was only much later, I don't remember the exact year, that she finally was promoted to being a professor. But anyway, that's what the seminar was about, was a mechanism for vision based on what was known and what wasn't known. And I would say that some of my ideas were correct and others were not, were wrong. But that really had nothing to do with, you know, this being the worst seminar that he had ever heard. But then it turned out, you know, I guess I learned it partly from some of his other students and partly from something that the other students wrote, that he basically did the same thing to everybody, and everybody gave the worst seminar he'd ever heard. And as I say, what I said at the beginning was sort of a rite of passage that, if, I guess, I don't know exactly why, but if you could survive that, then he would accept you as a graduate student. So I don't know what he actually thought of me, but it was just this incident, which is fine, man. But, you know, otherwise, you know, he had a very social relationship, Delbruck, with his students, you know, that he would give parties. He had Shakespeare readings, and it was called the Shakespeare and Spaghetti Club, I think, where at his house with his wife, he would invite, you know, the group of students, and they would do Shakespeare readings and such. And and the other thing is that the story of what happened with me and Feynman remembered by many people, and but they did, but in the retelling of it, they didn't know who the person was. I mean, in later years, that it was actually me. And one time I met Delbruck when I was at Cold Spring Harbor for a summer, and he was there giving lectures, and he seems to also had forgotten that we had this incident, and we had, you know, a very pleasant relationship. But other people, you know, told the story about what happened there in the climate.
Who were you living with at Caltech?
Well, initially I was living with Alex Rich. I mean, he had a roommate, Bob Schulman, who went to work Hughes Aircraft for a while. I don't remember what research he did, but Alex, when I met him at Woods Hole, said, "Look, would you like to live with me?" And so, you know, it seemed great to, you know, I was going out there, I didn't know anything about the place. And so I lived with him for a while, for a year. Now, what living with Alex meant was sort of unusual, because Alex kept a schedule where he would get up sometime in the afternoon and go to work and work all night. And I had a much more normal schedule. So we really only met for dinner. I mean, I would be cooking dinner, obviously, and we'd chat for a while. But otherwise, we never saw each other. And so it was nice. But then the next year, Gary Feldenfeld, who was officially the same year at Harvard, but I finished a year early, was taking this physiology course, and he finished and also came out to Caltech. And so we rented an apartment, and then we rented a house, actually, finally, in Altadena, where we had these parties and such.
What were the parties like?
Well, they were great fun, I mean, with dancing and drinking and firemen playing the bongo drums. And one of the things I did was we would buy very cheap wine, and we had a number of bottles of good wine that we had drunk, and so I would just pour the cheap wine into the, and then, you know, people, and there were these different great wines, and people would say, you know, this is really much better than this. It's just amazing how little most people who are wine connoisseurs really know about this. And I also made whiskey by taking some alcohol from the lab, very pure ethyl alcohol, and putting in some burnt sugar and a few other things. And so these were the experiments that I did. But we would have that at these parties. And one time, the Paulings came, and Pauling went. We had a backyard, and there were lots of snails. And what I remember is that he collected the snails to, you know, eat them. But I just wonder whether that's really true. Certainly, he collected the snails, but later discovered when I was collecting snails that it's really a very complex procedure for the, you have to let the snails diet, essentially, so they eat up all their slime before you actually try to take them out and cook them. So I don't know what, and I never asked him. Well, I didn't at the time know the complication. I learned that later when we were in the Otsawa, and then I did this. So I don't know, but there were, you know, it was a, you know, Caltech really had a wonderful atmosphere. Well, another thing, actually, with one time with Bell Burke and sometime with his friends, we went to the desert, the Mojave Desert, which is not that far away. And in the spring, there are these rains, and then there are plants that come up. They're called belly plants because you have to get down on your belly to see them because they're so small. And then they last for a little while, and then enough to form seeds or whatever. And so there were a lot of good experiences there. One another time, and this has nothing to do with the science, but we had sort of decided that we would go. I think it was New Year's Day. We would go up into the mountains and go skiing in the morning, and then come down to the beach and go swimming in the afternoon. It was just sort of an experience that you could have. And so in that sense, you know, Caltech was really a very friendly environment. All the professors treated you essentially as equals.
Was Feynman any good at the bongos?
Yeah, it was good enough. It was good for sort of dancing and jumping around. Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah.
There's a picture of him on the website, actually, which I have in one of my talks. So, yeah.
You began work with John Kirkwood in the chemistry department, and then Kirkwood got an offer to
from
leave.
Yale.
From Yale.
Yeah. And question came, but what would I do? I mean, while Kirkwood was there, I mean, Alex Rich and Erwin Oppenheim, both of whom I've mentioned, and I did ask Kirkwood whether we could. He gave this course, advanced course, very rigorous course in thermodynamics, whether we could make lecture notes. And so, you know, each one of us would take one of the lectures and sort of in cycles and write them up and work on them together. And that was a very good experience. Erwin Oppenheim, you know, had been working for Kirkwood for quite a while, knew more about the subject than either Alex or I did, but we worked together on this and put out this set of notes, which I think is still used to be in the Harvard, in the chemistry library. And then a year or two later, after Erwin had graduated, and he sort of wrote them up in a better way and published them with Kirkwood as a book. But so Kirkwood, I'd done something, but I'd not completed anything with Kirkwood by the time he left. I hadn't worked with him very long. And so at that time, Pauling asked all of Kirkwood's students whether or not they would like to work with him. At the time, Pauling wasn't taking any graduate students. He had only postdoctoral fellows working with him. But he said, look, if you stay here, you can work with me. Now all of the other people, Swanthick and Erwin Oppenheim and Salzman, others had worked with Kirkwood for a longer time and went with him to Yale, and I was really the only one who stayed, and so I was had a chance to be a graduate student with Pauling.
Was that the drive for why you stayed, to work with Pauling?
Yeah. I mean, I had sort of to decide, would I go along with Kirkwood, and I really liked Caltech and its atmosphere.
What was working with Pauling like?
Well, it was, he was, very open and had many good aspects. I mean, you had to sort of learn what it was like to work with Pauling, and there are a number of items. One was, at Caltech, each graduate student had a little open mailbox. Nowadays, the mailboxes aren't open anymore, but and every morning when I came in, I would see a little yellow note in my mailbox, which was a note from Pauling, signed Linus, where he would say, wouldn't it be interesting to da 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 da. I can't remember all the subjects, but I would see that, and I say, oh, Pauling wants me to look at that, and so I would start working on it, and then I would receive another note the next day saying, wouldn't it be interesting? And fortunately, that I knew some of the postdocs like Alex Rich and several, Massimo Simonetta, who was a friend for a long time, Jack Dunitz, who was there at the time. And they all said, well, we all get these notes from Pauling, and we just either throw them away or file them away. Maybe sometime later we will work on this subject, but he doesn't expect you to do anything on that. So that was one thing. And then, I did want to do something biologically related, and decided that Pauling was interested in hydrogen bonds, and he had some suggestions, but I decided to take the simplest hydrogen bonding system, which is the bifluoride ion, which is HFH, and tried to do a quantum mechanical study of the hydrogen bonding and the origin of it. And so I went there. Pauling said okay, basically, and I would talk to him about questions related to it and hydrogen bonding in general. And again, I went in to ask him questions. And one time I asked him a question, what he thought would happen with this particular hydrogen bonding environment. And he said, well, he sort of thought, and this was his custom, he would sort of look at the ceiling for a while and then come up with and gave me an answer. And I asked him, well, why do you think this is what's going to happen? And he gave me an explanation of this. And I said, yes, and walked out of his office and thought about it and talked with my friends about it. Clearly, explanation was wrong, and so I presumed the answer was that he came up with was wrong. So I went in again the next day and asked them. I told them, well, you know, this really doesn't make any sense. I probably said it in a somewhat more polite way, but I don't really know. And Paul said, yeah, you're right, you're right. And he thought again and gave me another explanation, but for the same, the end answer was the same one. And this happened when, again, it was wrong, this explanation. And the third time that I went in, he came up with a new explanation. The answer was just always the same, and that really made sense. And so, you know, this really was very important, this idea that, you know, he didn't sort of, somehow he intuited the answer. He was a man who had a, you know, astronomical knowledge of chemistry and everything and bonding and such. And somehow he was able to find the right answer without having thought through it. If he wrote a paper, then he would, you know, then it would work out why it was true. But this sort of was very important in my life, I think, in believing in intuition that, I mean, that, you know, you can actually sort of somehow work things out very crudely and come up with an answer that you think is meaningful. And often with my students nowadays, I'm sort of at the same stage, that I've got an idea. I think it would give such and such. And then I would sort of give them this idea, and they would work through it to really find the good explanation. If they asked me, I would give them sort of, you know, my rationale for this. But this, that you should believe in intuition. Not always, you know, you might be wrong in some cases, but that was very, very important in being able to do things. And then also Feynman once remarked that he had somewhat a similar thing, that he would have an idea. He would sort of very crudely try to see whether it made sense. And if it did seem to make sense, then he would sort of go back and work very carefully to make a description of a derivation, I guess is a better word, which was acceptable to the general public for a journal. And that, you know, it was the same idea that it was very important to have new ideas, but you shouldn't sort of work your way to a result if you don't know or don't have the feeling that it's really something very interesting.
How did that manifest for some of your later work, later in your career?
Well, basically, that, you know, I believe in my ideas, and even if other people said they were, you know, they made no sense in some cases.
What was an experience where you got pushback and you continued to pursue?
Well, that really has to do with molecular dynamics and what the Nobel Prize is for, in my thought, though not in the thought of the committee, but that's another question. But basically there, you know, I've been working on very simple systems and realized that even light atoms, which you would expect to be, like hydrogen atoms, which you'd expect to be as quantum mechanical as possible. I with Dick Porter had, let's get back, it's one of the papers that I didn't talk about, but just, anyway, that we calculated with classical mechanics, the reaction of a hydrogen molecule with a hydrogen atom to give a new hydrogen molecule and have one of the atoms kicked out, and studied the collisions and everything of that. And then sort of I felt that if classical mechanics could be used for these light atoms, it should be applicable to studying proteins. And so that's basically, we started doing molecular dynamics of that BPTI molecule. And there, you know, people, there was, like many of the people in chemistry, some of us still here now, actually, said, you know, we can't really understand the collision of and reactions of three or four atoms at a time. Why do you think you can study the behavior of a molecule that has 500 atoms or more? And the other was the biologists. I talked to them about doing this. I mean, I had some friends about it. I said, well, you know, it's not really very interesting. I mean, even if you can do it, so what? And so this initial stages where we did this, was clearly an area where people said it couldn't be done, and if you could do it, it wouldn't be very interesting. And I felt they were wrong, and certainly that's turned out to be true.
Yeah, follow your intuition there.
Yeah.
So you're at Caltech from 1950 to 53. You're around 20 years old when you start there,
right?
And you finish your PhD with Pauling in 53. Mm-hmm. What was the process of finishing your dissertation like?
Well, let me mention something earlier where one of the things you did, sort of in the middle, you had some sort of a candidacy exam, and this was an oral one. I mean, Harvard and I suppose other universities try to decide what's the best way of doing this. I mean, mainly good students, so it's not really to try to get rid of people or whatever. And so it goes from having oral exams to having written exams to special subjects to having qualifying exams where they don't know what it's going to be like. So it's, well, anyway, at Caltech at that time, they had the system of an oral exam, and Pauling and a number of other people came in, and you know, yeah, asked me various questions. It was going along fine. And then Pauling asked me about his theory of metals, which I knew, you know, about. But so I said, well, let me talk about copper. And I said, what's the atomic number of copper? And so Pauling said, well, start at hydrogen and go through the periodic table till you get to copper. And I couldn't do that. I'm not sure how many other people other than could do it, but anyway. So then he said, okay, well, this atomic number, copper, and then everything was sort of went fine, and we had a big celebration with Feynman and other people at the house. But afterwards, Pauling said, well, you know, you should really learn the periodic table. Every chemist should know the periodic table, which I don't think is true. But anyway, so in a gentle way, he took me aside. I mean, it wasn't a question about my being able to do things or anyway. And so I worked on the bifluoride ion. I realized very quickly that if you just did a quantum mechanical calculation, which what you could do at that time, which was with IBM card machines and such, and tables for integrals. I mean, it was really, there are a lot of things that now you just press a button and you can do, but at that time it was difficult to do. And so, well, I realized that at the level that one could study this very simple molecule quantum mechanically, you just couldn't get the answer without putting in some sort of empirical information. And it's particularly true that they're both ionic and covalent contributions, where the sort of the net bifluoride ion has one negative charge, and so the extra electron can be on one fluoride atom or the other fluorine atom, or you can have doubly charged, where you have a structure which has a negative charge on fluorine and hydrogen, a positive charge on the other fluorine. So the net charge is always minus one. And to get the correct spacing of these different energy levels, which you would include in what, in my case, it was a multivalence bond description, would require much higher level calculations than you could do. And so my idea was, well, you would put in experimental energies for putting an extra electron on these various atoms or removing one electron. The atomic description would be done from data that are known. There's a table of atomic energies where you could just look them up. And so I developed a method for introducing these into the problem, I was writing up my thesis. Another two things. One is that about the time I was writing up my thesis, Bill Moffitt, one of my predecessors here, was a really outstanding theoretician, came up with a method that was very similar to my own method. His method was better in some ways, and mine was better in other ways. But I asked Werner Shoemaker, who was one of the professors there, who actually had the function there, amongst other things. He did electron diffraction, but being sort of a person that Pauling bounced his ideas off, he was sort of really the only person there who could tell Pauling, well, this doesn't make any sense, Linus. I can still remember some of these meetings. So I talked with him about it. He said, well, don't worry. I mean, you did this originally. But I was so, I don't know, upset or disgusted that I never published my thesis. That's one thing. But then actually writing the thesis, which you asked about, happened. I'd been working on things, and it was essentially done, but I was procrastinating. And so Pauling came in one day and said to me, well, it would be nice, I'm going away for 3 months. It would be nice in about a week or something like that. I don't remember the exact time. It would be nice if you finished before I went away. And so, I said, I worked pretty hard, and I wrote my thesis in longhand, and various friends like Alex Rich and others typed it all up. And we finished it in time, and I had the exam, and everything went fine. And so the actual writing, not the work of doing the thesis, but the writing was done in a very short time. And I suppose I'm lucky, since I was able to do it. It was great that Pauling said that. I guess he was sort of aware of what the situation was, that I was done and just somehow wasn't writing it up.
How did you hear about the Moffitt publication? Did somebody come to you with it?
No, there is a... No. I mean, people didn't know. It was... There was a... it was a compendium that appeared at that time which included Moffitt's method and others. I don't really remember exactly how I found it, but I found it.
What was the initial reaction? Was it need to go camp in the wilderness for a while, or just get away from work for a little bit?
Well, it was just I was very unhappy about it, and as I say, I worried that having this, I'm not sure it was actually published, it was sort of a compendium from a meeting, but maybe that I wouldn't be able to get my degree with what I had done, even though, I mean, it was significantly different and more specialized than what Moffitt had done. But, I mean, that was really, I said, no, I was very unhappy for a while and didn't talk to anybody for a little bit, and then finally I talked to Werner Shoemaker, and he said, don't worry about it.
How has your writing process changed from that frantic 3 weeks of hammering out the dissertation and getting it done? Do you have a similar process now where you kind of lock yourself away and hammer something out, or how has that evolved, the way you write and publish now?
Well, it's, I mean, the first paper I published in chemistry was when I was a postdoc with Charles Coulson in Oxford at the time. I went basically, you know, and again I had sort of a similar problem that I was going to work with Leonard Jones, who was in Cambridge, you know, who was one of the outstanding theoretical chemists, and then he went to be the dean or something at another university. So I had to look for other people to work with, and I decided finally on sort of last minute on Coulson in Oxford, and went to work for him as a postdoctoral fellow. And well, there I had already sort of begun to think about what I would like to do is, if I was going to do theory in chemistry, that I would do something that was of utility in chemistry, not that was of interest to theoretical chemists who sort of had an in-group that talked to each other, but chemists didn't really do that much at the time. That was very useful. And so I had the idea that one should be calculate certain experimentally measurable properties, try to predict them and try to understand where they came from. And so I took, again, very simple, the hydrogen molecule, and calculated its quadrupole moment. And when you say, did I just sort of write papers easily? That time, I mean, I really suffered over that paper, thinking about it, could it be wrong, could it be this and that. And it took me a long time to finally submit it for publication in JChem Phys. And nowadays, I mean, things have changed a lot, and so I tell my students this, that when you start out, it may be very hard to be willing to sort of expose yourself, I guess, to the public in some sense. And you could be wrong or everything, and that it was very hard for me to write papers. Nowadays, mainly what happens is that, if I write a paper, whatever I write, it still takes me forever to be sure that I want to publish it, and that, and not that I want to publish it, but how to publish it to make sure that everything is correct. And I go over and over a paper over and over again. And if I'm working with students who may be writing the first draft, they suffer through, they give it to me, and it's still mainly true that I mark all over it by hand and give it back to them, and until we really think we have, I'm convinced that we have a paper that's clear and correct, and various students have told me, that they were very unhappy with me that I kept them for such a long time from actually finishing the paper. But nowadays, that they basically do the same thing when they have their positions and working with their students and this idea that you should be careful about what you write, and the more interesting your result is, the newer it is, the more you should really try to check that it is correct. And of course, since a lot of the work is done on computers, it's sort of hard to check. I mean, you know, it's a very complicated program, and I did, you know, students will agree on that, they mainly wrote the programs, and so, you know, that I had sort of, an intuition that something that came out didn't make sense, and they should go back and check it, and sometimes it was okay, and other times I picked out something that was wrong, even though, you know, you can't, unless you're going to go through the program, you know, line by line, which is impossible to do. So that's part of the process of writing papers and doing science nowadays. I don't know whether that's okay. I mean, we're sort of wandering all around. I don't know what
we'll. No, that's fine. I mean, sometimes we like to, when there's a relevant question that we could ask later, sometimes we like to ask it now, just so that way we don't lose it for later. But I think hearing a bit about your time at Caltech and finishing up your dissertation, you know, there are two questions that I think are important to get to. And, you know, one of them is, you know, Pauling gives you a relatively short time frame in which to finish your thesis. And of course, once you finish your thesis, your time at the university traditionally ends. What did you have plans in place when Pauling asked you to, you know, finish things up about what the next step would be? I know that you wound up at Oxford, but I wasn't sure if you had been planning to go to Oxford anyway, and it just happened to coincide with finishing your thesis, or were you scrambling to find something that you were going to do once your thesis finished? And I think that might be a good place to start. I also do want to ask a little bit about the Rosenbergs, who were executed in June of 53, because I know that you were involved in some protests about that. But I'd like to know a little bit more about what your plans were for after Caltech and when those came to fruition.
Well, I had gotten an NSF fellowship, and that was and it was to go to work with Leonard Jones, and the idea was that it would start. I was actually, I suppose, a little bit late, as it happened, but the idea was that it would start sometime in the fall of 53, when, you know, I actually finished my thesis, but probably somewhat later than it should have been. So I had this NSF fellowship, $3,000, which was a lot of money in those days, and I shifted it from Leonard Jones to Coulson, and it was one of the very first years of NSF fellowships, postdoctoral fellowships, and most people didn't use them to go overseas, but I don't think there was any. I don't think there was any rule about it. And when I said I had to change it, there was no problem about that. So I was all set in terms of going to Oxford.
Why is it that you wanted to go to Oxford in the first place? I mean, why did you apply for this?
Well, I first applied to Cambridge, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to go. You know, I hadn't been in. I was born in Europe, and I just wanted to go back to Europe.
Okay.
And it was also, as happened, you know, I decided I wanted to do traveling and such. As it's, but it was basically I wanted to go back to Europe. I decided to go to England because the really theoretical chemistry, I could have gone to Sweden where Per Olof of Dean was, but I decided, I mean, that really the best centers were in Cambridge, London, and Oxford. And I decided I didn't want to go to London exactly. I sort of, I suppose, it had been living in a relatively small Cambridge is sort of a small town,
mm-hmm.
All of Boston and Caltech and Pasadena is a small town, so I decided, that I wanted to get have a similar environment, but obviously it would be very different,
mm-hmm.
and so that was all set.
So you didn't have a sense, so I understand wanting to go back to Europe, getting to travel a little bit, but since these postdoctoral fellowships were new, was it common for individuals to do postdocs at the end of their graduate career at this time, or was it pretty common for individuals to go straight into positions?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what was the norm at that period of time.
Well, much more so than nowadays, the norm was to go into positions, and particularly organic chemists,
mm-hmm.
would go to work, would try to get an assistant professorship or instructorship or
mm-hmm.
something. Nowadays, almost everybody goes on and has a postdoctoral position, either paid by fellowship or paid by whoever he's
mm-hmm.
working for. But that really had a relatively small fraction of the PhDs went on to a postdoctoral fellowship at the time, though I don't really know the statistics.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any concerns about taking on a postdoctoral position instead of going to find a professorship or something like that?
No, I... I don't think I worry about it, and nobody said to me, look, you should really be trying to get, and they thought it was a good idea to get a postdoctoral fellowship, and
mm-hmm.
particularly since I had not really been in a place working with Pauling where sort of theoretical chemistry in the computational sense was being done. I was really unique in that group, so I thought, and people I talked to thought, that it would be good for me to be in a group where theoretical chemistry
mm-hmm.
was, everybody else was a theoretical chemist, and talking with people and such would be useful. So I think that was really...
I'm interested about that computational aspect. When was your first interaction with computers? Did Caltech have a computer you could run computations on?
No. I mean, it had these IBM punch card machine, and a lot of it was done on these electronic calculators, and sort of the equivalent of electronic typewriters, And a lot of what you did was that other people, as I mentioned, had there were tables of integrals and all of these things that you could look up and interpolate. I mean, it was really sort of at the limits of what you could do.
Is that part of the reason why the ab initio efforts with the bifluoride ion, there was a need to have the empirical data as part of it?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of it. It was the same thing with Moffat and other, that they just couldn't take care of all of these excitations to just put them in. As I said, nowadays, I don't know, it would take you maybe seconds to do the same calculation with a program like Gaussian and a reasonable computer, nothing special.
So,
sorry,
go ahead.
I was just thinking, it wasn't really true of the bifluoride, but one thing that can happen is that you can have an idea and execute it, and it's before its time, before anybody else will use that idea and carry on. And when I was here, I mean, I mentioned these things because they come up and probably wouldn't necessarily come up and it wasn't the bifluoride ion, but it was just the hydrogen fluoride molecule. And there we're doing sort of ab initio calculations, but with a sort of a very small basis set, as one says. And so I had the idea that we would get a better description of the wave function if we constrained the calculations so that the dipole moment of the molecule came out to be agree with the experimental value. If you just did the calculation at the level, I mean, it's similar to the other, at the level that one could do, it wouldn't give the right sort of ionic character. And we could have tried using the Moffat-type method, which actually one of, I went back to this type of method with a student, Gabriel Balancurdy, and wrote a number of papers about improving it and putting it in the framework of better calculations. So I did publish something, though the original thing wasn't. But so we constrained, had the idea of constraining the wave function with an experiment, with experimental molecular data. And the interesting thing is that recently, maybe in the last 5 years or so, people have rediscovered this idea, and it's become very popular. And some of the people actually are aware of this paper, but I don't think it had any real effect. And there was somebody at MIT worked on this, and I told him, look, you know, the idea is the same as what you're doing now. And he was very interested in it. So the point is that, yeah, it was a good idea, but, you know, it had really no effect on scientific progress. And I don't know what one says about ideas like that. But this has happened a number of times where we did something in a simple way, and it's, you know, it didn't contribute in any way. That's something. I don't know how you decide that you're ahead of your time, but you discover it afterward.
Mm-hmm. When you're looking back.
Yeah.
Before we move into the political realm, do you mind if we take
right,
a break?
Rosenberg.
Do you want to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you did mention that you switched from Cambridge to Oxford. You're going to go to the Coulson group. I don't know if you specifically mentioned why it was that you wanted to switch from Cambridge to Oxford. Was it just the city that you wanted to be in, or was there something about the Coulson group that attracted you?
No, it was that the person I wanted to work with in Cambridge,
mm-hmm,
left Cambridge and became head of something or other. You know, this seems to be part of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then I had to choose, and I think we sort of recorded that, I had to choose someplace. And
right.
Coulson actually just come to Oxford from London,
mm-hmm,
and was working what was called the Mathematical Institute,
mm-hmm,
but was mainly almost entirely devoted to his group, and he was just establishing his group there, and there were some people there that I was aware of and didn't know personally, so in terms of the possible choices in England, that seemed to be the best place to go.
Okay. And you mentioned that you deferred this a little bit because of, you know, finishing things up. Originally, it was supposed to be the fall that you were going to be taking the fellowship, but you pushed it.
Yeah.
When did you wind up starting there?
I started a little bit before Christmas.
Okay, so closer to the end of the calendar year.
The calendar year.
In 54.
There was no problem about that. And what happened is that, well, I came there, and it was really just before Christmas, and one of the friends that I made, Sidney Bernard at Caltech, he lived in the same this house that we had, was in Cambridge, and he had been to Paris a couple of times, and he suggested that we go to Paris together, and so I basically went in to see Coulson and said, would you please sign my fellowship that I have arrived, but I'm going to go off to, to Paris for a couple of weeks.
So you you finished up your degree in 53. You went abroad in 54. What were you doing in the interim?
No, it was...
That was in the fall of 53.
It was the fall of 53, and then I got there. I went home here, actually. I had an operation for a hernia, and then stayed a week or two with my parents. This operation went right over. So.
Okay, yeah. In my notes, I had you starting in 54, not in 53, so I was thinking December of 54.
No, it was actually almost immediately. I mean,
Okay. Okay, so, and before we touch on that and your trip abroad, you had earlier mentioned receiving the Leica camera, so I'm sure that we'll talk a little bit about the photography that went on. But I also did want to know a little bit more about how you became involved in the protests over the deaths of the Rosenbergs. And it might be good, we may touch on it more later on, but you know, were there any ramifications for you in becoming involved in protesting their deaths?
Yeah. Well, this I don't remember exactly how I was involved. And there was this Unitarian Church in LA. I mean, we used to go to LA to go to movies and. So, and also there was this Unitarian Church which had various speakers that were interesting, and I and different other students sometimes would go down there. I mean, I had a car, some of the others had cars. There was no other way to really get around in the LA area. It's still pretty difficult, but, and then you know, the Rosenbergs, at that time, they were accused of being spies, but it wasn't really clear. It turned out that, in fact, they really had been. But there were protests about what the government was doing to them, and so I participated in one of these meetings, and what it was. Clear that I mean they asked for your names, and it was my impression that there was an FBI agent there who was taking down these names. I mean that was we didn't really do anything. Certainly, it was nothing illegal, but somehow it appeared in my record. And actually, I finally, thanks to the Nobel Prize. I was able to get in touch with the lawyer of Obama and said, look, for years I've been trying to get my FBI file because I know there are some things in there. And I had applied and the help of actually my son, Misha, who is a lawyer, though he's going in other directions, but and always gotten... Well, I got answers after, but that said, well, we were working on it or something or other. But as soon as this happened, one of the legal people told them, I guess, you know, that they should give me my file. And so it then took about a month. They said, well, we have to go through all the papers and make sure that anything that should be redacted, should be pointed out. And so I think within about a month, I got this file of, it's about 400 pages.
Your FBI file?
Yeah, mainly junk. I mean, it's really, well, the amazing thing that comes out is that how much effort the government, FBI, wastes on this, where there's really nothing that's particularly incriminating. The few things. I mean, the way I originally found out. Well, there were two things that happened. Well, there were three things that happened actually. You mentioned what were the after effects, and I mean, I think partly with the Rosenbergs, it was we felt that. The government was doing something wrong, but and also it was part of a social activity, again, that people, like-minded people. And so this is really an aside, but between Illinois and Columbia, when I walked down the street in Urbana, Illinois, I had the feeling that almost everybody there wasn't necessarily connected with the university, had different political views from mine. While walking down the street in New York, I felt that almost everybody had the same political views. Sort of being more comfortable in an environment. But the after effect, well, there were several things. One was that I was invited to participate in a National Academy meeting in Woods Hole, where they have a building on disarmament and such. And one of the things was that people had to have the clearance to participate in this meeting. And I never got a clearance. I mean, I went to the first meeting, and after that, they said you had to have a clearance. And really, the feeling was that, I mean, the clearance was required at the behest of the National Academy, because they said if people didn't have a clearance, then the people that were trying to influence would say, well, you don't know what you're talking about, because a lot of this is secret. And so I didn't get a clearance, and had a nice summer in Woods Hole. Now I was older and young children, and so I knew there was something in my file. I never found out. And then my brother was invited to spend some of his time at Livermore, and I guess Edward Teller wanted him to work there. It was doing some theoretical work that had nothing to do with the hydrogen bomb or anything else. But again, at that time, to work there, you had to have a clearance. And when he applied, his clearance was denied. Then Teller or whoever said, look, we want this guy. And then he did get a clearance. And again, I didn't quite know what, because my brother, and there was no reason, and the only thing I could think of was that I was a person that in his past that was suspicious. But it turns out in the FBI report that I got, that turns out not to be entirely true, and that when he had young children, he started to teach, go to classes and teach them about elementary science. And he got very interest in elementary education, and somehow one of the schools where his children were going, the head of that school, I don't know, had some sort of leftist leanings. Mm. And that was held against him, and that was in the report that I was the brother of this person who had, so it wasn't only I that was guilty, but he was also guilty. But it's again one of these crazy things that happened. And and the third thing that happened is that when I was on the faculty of the University of Illinois, I kept getting visits from the FBI. And what usually happened is that there was one person from Chicago who came down, and he came with somebody else. And they asked me questions. When I was taking trips, with Gary Felsenfeld, we drove through Yugoslavia to Greece, and a lot of photography there. And they sort of asked me, well, did you associate with any communists in Yugoslavia? And I said, well, most people are communists. And then one time they came down and brought somebody along, and he started speaking to me in Serbo-Croatian, you know, expecting that I would sort of show that I was really secretly knew all this. Of course, I didn't. And this kept on going for a while, and then finally it stopped, and it didn't, as far as I know, after that, disappeared, but I was never told, oh, you're all right. And again, this appears in my file, there was some reference in terms of, you know, my being inducted into the army, where it was actually had always deferments during the Vietnam War, and so my local board wanted me. They kept saying, well, why don't you get it over with? And I said, well, I'm happy to wait as long as I can get a deferment. I won't serve, and may have had something to do with that. But I never really found out what was going on. And there's only so far that you can go with these things. Yeah. So I think overall, and the effect was very small in my life. But I would say my one sort of take home lesson is that the government truly wastes a lot of money trying to follow up on these things for no reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's in fact an earlier experience when I was going to high school, or junior high school actually, we moved to Newton from Brighton and Alston, where we had lived. We bought a small house, and one day an FBI man came to our house, and he was very polite and very apologetic. He said, well, your neighbor, whom we had never really had very good relations, I think we were one of the very first Jewish families in Newton. Now it's probably 50% Jewish, but maybe that was it. I don't know. But he said that your neighbor says that every time when your father goes off to work, he sort of faces the porch and raises his hand and says, Heil Hitler. And the FBI agent said, look, I know this must be crazy. You know, he knew our history and that we'd escaped from the Nazis and everything, but he said he was sorry he had to come and check on it. And he said, well, you won't hear anything more about it. And we didn't. And that's not in my record, but just know from remembering what happened at the time. Mm-hmm. So
Pauling went on to have a lot of political engagements with the government, getting his travel visa revoked at certain times from the State Department. Did you and he ever talk politics? Did he ever talk about his political views with you?
Yes, we talked quite a bit, about the atomic energy and such. And one thing that happened is that he was sued. Well, no, he's the Daily Mirror, I think, called him a communist. And so he sued the Daily Mirror, and there was a trial in New York. And since I was at Columbia, he asked whether I could be a witness for him, and he had various other people as witnesses. And so I came down there and said that this, as far as I know, he was against atomic warfare. You know, he was at that time, he was already trying to stop testing of nuclear weapons in the air, and that for which he got the Nobel Prize. And so I testified for him, and and so finally he lost the case. And the reason he lost the case was that he would have had to show that it did him harm to have this published. And he said, if you can get all these great people to vouch for you, obviously, it didn't do any harm. So
legal rationale there.
Way things go. And actually, this May, I'm going to give a talk for it's the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and they are having a certain anniversary. Of course, they've been very much in the news recently because of Syria and everything, and they got the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, the same year that I got the Chemistry Prize, and so they invited me to come down and to give a keynote lecture, and so I stewed a little bit over this. What would I say? But one of the things that I've found, and partly it's looking back about it, when Pauling got his Nobel Peace Prize, and that he said that Nobel had hoped that his weapon, dynamite, was sufficiently destructive. I mean, it was used in war. He didn't invent it for war. It was used for mining and such. That it would be strong enough to make people realize that you couldn't have war, that if you could annihilate the battalions in a few seconds, war would just be impossible. Of course, he was quite wrong about that, and the world had to wait until the atomic bomb, essentially, where really, so far, it appears to have been so horrible that there haven't been any world wars, of course, local conflicts, but that it's actually its existence may well have had the effect of making world wars impossible, and so that this is this balance of destruction and such that has helped. Now, what will happen with North Korea nowadays, I don't know, but my guess is, again, it's just like India and Pakistan. They both have, I don't know how many, half a dozen bombs, and they're not going to use them. But maybe it's even helping for them to try to make peace, that there is this destructive power. So anyway, that's the sort of thing I will talk about a little bit, and then other things about actual chemical warfare.
It's actually interesting. You can look throughout much of modern history, and many of the inventors of destructive weapons have discussed the fact that they thought that destructive weapon would prevent would stop warfare. Like Hiram Maxim, when he was talking about his machine gun, it was, this machine is so destructive, no one would be foolish enough to engage in warfare, so war will stop. Because
that was who?
Hiram Maxim, the inventor of the Maxim machine gun. So one of the first automatic machine guns.
I said, can you send me a reference to
sure.
that? Because
sure.
I might add it.
Sure,
to
definitely.
My talk.
So in December, you go over, you take your trip to Europe. It's been 15 years since you were there last.
Mm-hmm.
You get Coulson to sign your form that you showed up, and then you wanted to take a trip. Right. Were there specific places that you wanted to visit? You mentioned going down to Greece, I believe.
Well, I mean, this first trip was just to go to Paris.
Okay.
And Paris for food. I mean, I didn't know my French was limited.
Mm-hmm.
But and so we went there to wander around where everybody goes. You know, the Left Bank. We have this hotel that Sidney Bernard, who had gone there earlier, had found the Hotel de Deux Continents, where for a long time we used to go there with an inexpensive hotel, and it was just for the fun of it and for the food, and we did go to this, well, we didn't actually go there as customers to the La Perouse, which was a very famous three-star restaurant in Paris. I don't know, it's another whole story. I don't know how much of it, I've forgotten how much of it appears in my Spinach article, but that's what
I mean, as much as you'd like to say, and if there, I mean, if it's repetitive, we can always excise things later if it makes sense to do so. But we're happy to have as much as you're willing to share.
And I'll see everything that's recorded.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, well, I had gotten a card from the Crimson that I was a reporter for them, which was true. I was planning to write an article basically about how an American that doesn't know very much French would thrive in one of these very fancy restaurants. And so we went to La Perouse, I and Sydney, and told them this, and they were really the owner of it, Opalinsky, I can't really remember his name, but that was really a great idea. His maitre d' was less favorable, but since the owner thought it was a good idea, the other one was, he said, fine. And so they gave us a very nice dinner and asked us to comment on it. And I had my Leica with me, and Sydney was officially my photographer, though he really didn't know much about photography, and sort of held, he took some reasonable pictures, but most of them were pretty bad. But I had to sort of say, it looks as if he doesn't know what he's doing, but he really takes great pictures. And then sort of the high point was that they took us down into the cellar, the wine cellar, where they, have all these great wines. In particular, they have one area where the wines that are without labels because the Seine flooded, and so they don't know, what they are. And so they went down there, and they would sort of open the bottle and say, yes, this is Chateau Margaux from 1934, could be, great vintage and such. And so Topolinsky was the guy's name. And the maitre d', I don't know, would sort of discuss the wines and ask us about, of course, we had no idea about it, and whether they really could tell or not, I don't know, but it was just sort of a wonderful, unbelievable sort of experience. So we did that, and I did write an article, but I wrote it for the New Yorker, but they never published it.
I wonder if they were filling old bottles with the cheaper one as you had the new
one. I think this was for real. the wine was good, but to say that it was from such a, and I could tell whether it was a Bordeaux or Burgundy, but to tell which vineyard and which year, that was just, and these were all very good wine, the ones that we tasted, and it was just interesting to see these people, and I think they probably didn't know. I mean, from what I've seen later on, when I've worked in some of the three-star restaurants, that the sommeliers really know what they're doing. And
Where else did you visit in Europe? I know you took multiple trips. Where else were places that that stood out for you?
I took this one trip that I mentioned that went through what used to be Yugoslavia all the way to Greece, and I was just what was a great experience. You know, there essentially weren't any tourists there. There weren't any tourists that were driving there. The roads were in terrible shape, except there was this one highway where there was, you know, this was still under the communists, as I mentioned earlier, under Tito, when it was one country. And so everybody was, you know, was very friendly. I mean, one thing was that, you know, it was just after the war, and so many of the people spoke German. I mean, so I could actually easily communicate with them, which was very good. And we had, well, it was just seeing this culture and such, which I realized, you know, would 10 years later probably wouldn't be there anymore the way they was then. So it was, and we had a number of experiences that were, one was that the roads were very rough, and so the axle of the Volkswagen broke. And so we were near enough to a town and went to a garage, and the person said, "We can order you one, but that'll probably take a month to get here." And so he made me a new one, and he didn't charge us anything for it. I mean, we had a dinner together, and that was very, that was one time. Another time, I mean, I have a photograph. There were in one of the inland lakes, and there were a couple of fishermen and a fish buyer. Maybe I'll show it to you. This is the picture. And so these fishermen had come in, and this man was just probably some government official was buying the fish, and then they finished with that, and so then they said, "Well, now it's lunchtime," and so they made a fish stew and invited me to have the fish stew with them. Mm-hmm. And then I also found out what this ladder was for, which is that somebody climbs up on this ladder and throws down rocks so that the fish will go into their nets.
Wow.
And anyway, so there were a lot of experiences like that, because, you know, we were really, you know, sort of, they had very few people, and particularly people that could speak German to them. I mean, yeah. Mm. I mean, there was no real trouble getting into. There was some problem. I mean, we did have a visa, and my name was misspelled or something like that at the border when we first went there, but that was fine. And one time we got lost, and we drove toward Albania, and there we were met by armed guards and such, and again, I was finally able to communicate with them and say, "Look, you know, we're just lost. We're not, you know, some sort.
We're not invading your country."
You know, provocateurs or whatever. So we left.
Did you ever make it back to Vienna? Did you make it back to Vienna during this stint?
Yes, yeah.
What was that like being back there?
Well, it was at that time, this was, Vienna was still under the four-power agreement. So Vienna was divided into zones, just the way Berlin was. And my uncle had come, who had been in New Zealand during the war. Actually, that's another story, that my grandfather on my mother's side now had a clinic where he had people who came with rheumatism and such, and he used this radioactive mud from Italy. It was called the fungo, was the name of it, which I always thought was a nice, interesting name, but then I discovered relatively recently that it's just the word for mud. And he had the fungo Heilandstadt, it was called, and when the Nazis took over Austria, somebody came to him and said, well, I guess, sorry, his son, he had one son and three daughters, one of whom was my mother, and the son was actually put into a concentration camp in Dachau. And the guy came to him and said, look, if you turn over the fungo to me, I will get your son out. And of course my grandfather said, sure, and did it. And fortunately the person kept his word and said, yeah, he'll be out in 3 days and then he has to leave immediately. He'll only have a couple of days to be in Austria, and so there's no way of his getting a visa to the U.S. But he was able to get a visa to New Zealand. He was actually a chemist, and was interested in food chemistry, and so he passed the war in New Zealand and then came back after the war, and the family got the fungal Heilandstab back, and he was running it, and so we visited him there, and stayed there, and well, it was what was it like? I was just interested in looking around and seeing what was going on, and I didn't really have any strong feelings, you know, about belonging or anything. You know, I mean, just now that, you know, I had a Nobel Prize and was really feted by Vienna a year ago in April, where we were over there and were inducted into their National Academy and many other things. I mean, people always ask me sort of, what do I feel? And I guess each time I was given something or other, like the Légion d'honneur or something like that, you know, I always had to make a little speech, and various times I said, well, you know, I left Vienna 75 years ago and I heard nothing, and all of a sudden to be remembered, it seems to me a little bit late. And people took it very well, and many of them said, well, the mayor of Vienna was made honorary citizen of Vienna, which is sort of nice because they have part of the city hall. They have a stone plaque and where they carve your name into this plaque. And there are not that many people whose names are there. But the mayor said, you know, in his speech, well, you know, we can't undo what we did, but we can try to make sure that it will never happen again, and that the young people are aware of what was done. And I said, you know, that one of the people asked me, would I accept these honors if Vienna offered them to me? They would understand if I said no. And I did say yes. And in one of my speeches, I said, you know, it's very important for me to be back and bear witness for young people, you know, that somebody who still exists is alive, and that to strengthen this idea of what a horrible thing it was that was done, and that it won't happen again. Of course, there's a lot of anti-Semitism now still there, as was then. Anyway, so how are we doing?
Great.
Good. So, you know, we heard a little bit about some of the trips that you were taking. When did you, so you came, saw Coulson, you went on the trip to Paris. When did you actually wind up settling in Coulson's lab? Was it around January of 54?
Yeah, it was just sort of, it was just after New Year, because in France, New Year's is more important than Christmas holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And basically started working then. So
what was it like coming into his lab? I mean, how many people were there? What was it?
Well, they were there. It probably had a couple of senior people. Simon Altman, who I became very good friends with, him and his wife, and he was very versed in group theory, which was subject that I sort of had a group seminar that we held at Caltech that I'd organized, because there aren't courses in group theory where we taught each other group theory. And so, and there were other people, you know, who were theoretical chemists, and then there were visitors like Don Horneck was there for part of the time, and Bill Lipscomb visited. And but there were two things about my stay with Coulson. One was that, you know, I wasn't at all interested in the problem that he gave me. And as I sort of mentioned, you know, I worked on this trying to understand the quadrupole moment, and I wanted to do things that were of chemical interest. And so I spent quite a bit of the time thinking about what area could I work in that what I would do really would have utility in chemistry as a whole. And there was courses taught by Professor Price in physics on electron spin resonance and various, mainly in solids, but this, and I talked with Don Horneck and other people. And really, I did nothing for Coulson. I mean, I did this small project, which he wasn't very interested in, but decided that magnetic resonance was an area which was just sort of beginning in chemistry, applications of nuclear magnetic resonance, that that would be an important area to work in. And I also decided, well, since I really didn't want to do the problem that Coulson gave me, I would follow the instructions of my fellowship, which says that you should obey the customs of the country, of the university where you're at. And in England, you know, they have terms that are, I think now, 6 weeks long, and then in between the terms, they have 8 weeks off. Mm-hmm. Now, what normally happens is that the students have a good time during the 6 weeks in term, their plays and all kinds of other things, and then in between terms, they actually do their work. But what I did was I'd be there during the term, and then in between terms, I would go off on one of these trips that we took, and I wrote the NSF and said that that's what I was doing, and they said, fine. So that, I mean, that was, so it was, you know, I was 23 years old. I, you know, worked very hard to get a PhD and all through school, so I sort of felt this was a good time to see a little bit of the world. And also Gary Felsenfeld, who I mentioned, came over again the year after, and we bought the Volkswagen, and that's what we traveled around into various places. And interestingly enough, I was in Paris with my daughters, and also my son was there, and because there was an exhibition of the photographs, of which this is the catalog, at the Bibliothèque Nationale, and they couldn't come for the opening because it was in the middle of school, so they came at the beginning of the summer. And it turned out that this hotel where we had stayed for a while, we had stopped staying there and we're now staying in a better hotel, was having some sort of an anniversary, and they would get very inexpensive rooms, so stayed there with everybody. And one time we were in the lobby and Gary Felsenfeld was there with his wife, Naomi. And you know, it turned out that he had continued, every time he came to Paris, he stayed in this hotel. And that he'd actually taken the Volkswagen back to the U.S. and used it for another 10 or 12 years until, and although I knew he was at NIH and not been aware of all this, and then I was also told about the exhibition which he went. So that was sort of a nice thing, a serendipitous thing that happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Coulson, I don't know whether. Mm-hmm. So that was basically, I was reading a lot, and as I say, finally decided from reading and hearing lectures and such that chemical applications of nuclear magnetic resonance would really be an area where there would be new information that would be a good area to work in.
Mm-hmm. We're in terms of nuclear magnetic resonance, was this theoretical, or were, I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase the question. I'm also curious about the instrumentation that winds up getting used and developed over time. Was it something that did Coulson's lab have an NMR? Were those devices really available?
But they were all, at that time, they were homemade.
Mm-hmm.
And Harvard had one where actually but one of the sort of co-inventors, I mean, there were several. There was Felix Bloch, who was at Stanford, and there was, that's one of the things that names is.
Mm-hmm. We can always add names later.
Yeah, but he was also a Nobel Prize winner and at Harvard, who he, with somebody working with him, also developed the spectrometer here, and both Herb Gutowski, when he was a graduate student, a postdoc at Harvard, and Charlie Schlichter worked with him, and then they both went to the University of Illinois. Charlie Schlichter was a chemist and was a physicist, and Herb Gutowski was a chemist. And so they, again, both built instruments there and started doing measurements on organic molecules, Charlie Schlichter on solids. And Charlie, he did some theoretical work on chemical shift and such, and was very much, very important force in these early days. That's horrible, I can't remember. Ed Purcell.
Okay.
Was the person here who, yeah, he's had students who have actually gone into biology, but after, there's still somebody here. Yeah. But anyway, so that that was the place where chemical applications were going on. I think at Stanford, mainly we're doing physics, solids and such. And so, again, it sort of was pure luck that Pauling gave a lecture, I guess, in chemistry at the University of Illinois, and they asked him, did he have any students who might, not about NMR or anything, who might be, that he might recommend, and so he recommended me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not published any paper in chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
The H2 molecule hadn't come out yet.
Okay.
I published papers on birds, but not that. And they just offered me the job. I mean, they didn't know anything about me other than that Pauling said they should hire me. They didn't interview me. They didn't really offer me much of anything. I mean, it was compared to what happens nowadays, where there are these long courtships and mm-hmm. students visit and everything. There was none of that. And as it turned out, they offered me the job before they got the recommendation letter from Coulson, which said, you know, he's a very bright guy, but he really didn't do anything. So I don't know what the effect would have been.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I was there and everything, it was sort of a laughing matter that this had happened. But I don't know what I asked Butowski to become the. They had divisions there, and the physical. He was in charge of the physical chemistry division, and what they would have done, and he never said really whether they would have offered me the job anyway or mm-hmm. not. Like, the other thing that was important at Illinois was that for a long time, Roger Adams had been chairman of the chemistry department, and he was anti-Semitic, so there was no Jewish members of the chemistry department, and he retired, and Herb Carter, who was an organic chemist, actually hired four Jewish, three physical chemists with, I think, Herb Butowski's advice, and one inorganic chemist. So there was this, plus a couple of other young, so there was a whole group of young people, about half a dozen of them, and that, you know, so it was a very friendly, you know, these were all junior faculty members. Mm-hmm. That there was a lot of friendly interactions and such.
Mm-hmm. So just one quick question. How did you find out about the position at Illinois? I mean, you know, obviously there's no internet. People knew that you were at Coulson's lab. Did you receive something in the mail? Was it a phone call to the lab offering you the position? How did you actually find out about that?
Well, I heard from Pauling that he had recommended me, and then I received a letter from Herb Carter offering me the position.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean,
what was that transition like from being in Oxford to Champaign-Urbana?
Well, it was... For me, it was, you know, it was a place that was boring in terms of living compared to being in Europe, and clearly, you know, I had not accomplished very much while I was in Oxford scientifically. I mean, in a real sense, in terms of deciding that NMR was an area to work in, it was very important in my life, but in terms of producing things, and so when I came to Illinois, I sort of felt really ready to try to work hard and do something in this area, which I thought could be where I could do things that could be really important. So it was, I think it was good to be in the nowhere place, if you like. So it turned out that Aaron Cooperman was my office mate and was an experimentalist, but also theoretician, and we actually, he had gone there a little bit earlier, and there was an apartment to rent right next door to where he lived, so we had a lot of interactions which were very positive.
If you had had the choice, would you have, so I think this might be a long, complicated question, we'll see if I can pare it down. Obviously, if someone offers you a job, it's very nice just to jump on that offer, right? But had you had any plans prior to that job offer to go on the job market? And if so, were there certain universities that you were thinking of applying to?
I think it happened early enough that I really hadn't started to worry about what my future would be like.
Okay.
I mean, although I went, you know, almost a year after I got the offer,
mm-hmm.
but I just hadn't worried about that.
Okay.
And if you ask me, would I have picked Illinois if I had gotten other offers?
Or, you know, were there other universities that you were thinking of yourself as wanting to be at going forward? Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously you have a network of individuals that you've worked with or spoken with over long periods of time. You've seen those individuals go to universities. You have a sense of what the departments are like at those various universities. I was just wondering if there was some place that you thought you would want to be, even if it wasn't, you know, even if mm-hmm. it was going to be something down the line. But, like, did you have visions of where you wanted to situate yourself in terms of the the science that you wanted to look into?
Well, you know, I always thought about Harvard,
mm-hmm.
but I also thought that I didn't want to go to Harvard unless I had tenure. Because in those, just like with Delbruck, I mean, my psyche wasn't such that I wanted to sort of suffer, you know, not knowing what would happen. And of course, in those years, junior people were very rarely promoted. And they always hired people from the outside. So nowadays, the situation really has changed, I would say, for two reasons. One, that I think at Harvard, there's too much competition for Harvard, and that people wouldn't come here as junior faculty if their chance of staying was very, very low. They just go to somewhere else, to Stanford, Berkeley. I mean, there are many schools that compete with Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, there's been sort of the realization that if Harvard said, okay, you have a chance for tenure, and that it could get much better junior people to come here, which it used to be true, and now almost, I guess, all of the junior people that have been here in the last few years have been promoted. They're all outstanding, and they've been promoted very, very quickly. And so the policy really has changed.
Mm-hmm.
But in my day, you know, I just come here, and then we're told, well, nice having you here. And the idea was that if you were at Harvard, did good work, that you'd have a very good chance of getting a job elsewhere. And to a certain extent, that was true. But I just didn't like the idea of it. And in some sense, it didn't come up. I mean, it came up later a little bit. Various times, Harvard asked me about the possibility. And I just said I wasn't interested.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The position at Illinois was an instructorship.
Right.
Right. So was your hope to move towards the tenure track? Or was the realization
that you just had to teach? Well, instructorship was tenure track in those days. It was just they paid you less. And I think it was $5,000 instead of the $3,000 I've had as a fellow. No, it was just the first position on the tenure track.
Okay.
Yeah.
The work with nuclear magnetic resonance at Illinois, how did that proceed?
Well, I came there, you know, being interested, and talked with Herb Gutowski about what they were doing, and then so that was one thing, what they were able to measure, and ethyl alcohol was one of the classic systems where they were able to identify all the nuclei and look at their spin-spin coupling and such. And well, I'd realized that measurements of that type, where you have two hydrogen atoms that are not directly bonded to each other, but say in ethyl alcohol you have a hydrogen, a carbon, and another hydrogen, or you have a methyl group, and then you have CH2 and OH, but just from the simplest point of view, you have these two hydrogens that, in a simple description, would have a bond to their carbon, then there would be a carbon-carbon bond, and then there would be another CH bond. And I realized that if there was actually an interaction between the two...
The two hydrogens?
Yeah, that that was measured by... spin-spin coupling constant, that would tell you that there was necessarily not only this sort of simplest valence bond structure, but there were also structures where the hydrogen atoms were bonded together. And the mechanism qualitatively was this contact interaction. But my idea was that you would be able to measure the deviation from the simplest possible model but there had to be some sort of structure where these two were essentially bonded together. It would make a very small contribution. It would be, say, I remember 90% this, and maybe 3 or 4% this, and then there were other structures. So my idea was that if one could, you know, interpret that, one would get actually a measure of what the wave function was like, just like sort of measuring the quadrupole moment of the hydrogen molecule, or putting in the dipole moment. I mean, these various things, this theme appears over and over again, that that if you had a model, that you would be able to get information about the wave function from experiment. And so that's why I started looking at this particular problem. And so I worked out the formulation, and again there are these molecular integrals that you have to put in, and set up the calculation. And then Illinois had a computer called the ILIAC, which had 1,000 words of memory, which is unbelievable nowadays. But and so I programmed the problem for the ILIAC, not because if I did it once, the calculation, it would have been just faster to do it by hand than writing the program, which was pretty complicated. But if you had done it once, and then you wanted to look at the same interaction, but just to change the angle between the hydrogens, let's say as the methyl group rotated, then once you had a program that worked and gave the correct answer, redoing the calculation would be much, much faster if you wanted to do, you know, 20 of them for different angles or something like that. And so, you know, so I wrote this program, and it was a program on paper tape in those days, and you punched holes in the tape to, you know, to do the program. If you made a mistake, you filled in the holes with nail polish and such, and no, it all worked out. And then, well, it just turned out that a fellow from Canada, from a university in Canada, Lemieux, gave a lecture about organic chemistry. And I went to this lecture, and I don't remember why I went to this lecture, but because I usually didn't go to organic one. But he actually had measured coupling constants in some molecules and seen there appeared to be some sort of angular dependence, but he didn't, of course, you would really have to be able to fix them at all this different, and that you can't do experimentally. But he sort of mentioned this, and I realized that basically, you know, he sort of had data that showed that my model was correct. So I wrote up a paper, published this in JChem Phys, and my idea, you know, was, as I mentioned, was just to understand and use the measurement to understand the wave function. But as it turned out, measuring these coupling constants is turned out to be very, very important for finding the conformations of organic molecules, and also now being used in protein structure determinations by nuclear magnetic resonance. And I mentioned that, you know, there were a number of young people who weren't married at the time, and we used to go out to dinner at a Chinese restaurant in Pasadena and chat about new things that we had discovered and such that might be of interest. And I'm E.J. Corey was one
in,
of...
In Urbana?
Yeah, in Urbana.
Oh, okay.
He was in the faculty in Urbana, and it was just at this time. And I told him about this calculation, and he was very excited about it. And very shortly after, published a paper where he used the measured coupling constants to determine, you know, what the angle, what certain angle were in some rigid molecules, and that was sort of the beginning of the Karpless equation, which now is very famous. And I would say that more people know my name because of that, because it's taught in all the organic courses, than about the molecular dynamics and all that stuff. Maybe now more people begin to know about the other, but that really was, it's one of the most cited papers. And there's other stories that go along with that, but organic chemists started using it and testing it, and then they found there were sort of small deviations, you know, that where they could measure the angle in some other way. And there were three communications that said, you know, that the equation wasn't all that good. And so I published the paper saying, you know, they should have really read the original paper and seen that, you know, that it's mentioned that there are all these perturbations that can happen if you put in a highly electronegative molecule, atom, or various other things, that the simple model that I made wouldn't be accurate. And I ended the paper with a statement something like that anybody who tries to determine the angle, the dihedral angle, does so at their own peril. And fortunately, I think people didn't take it too seriously and kept on using it, and people have refined it, done lots of things with it, but it's really, it turned out to be very, very important. And there, in contrast to what I did for HF that I mentioned earlier, where it had no effect in chemistry, this was just at the right time, where more and more people were using magnetic resonance and having this relationship turned out to be very important, but it's an accident. I wasn't doing it to do conformational analysis, but I think that Corey published something about it. He was already a well-known organic chemist, certainly helped to spread it around. And
how did the publishing process go for you with this paper? You hadn't published much previously. I'm assuming by this time the quadrupole moment paper had come out.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like submitting this for publication, and how did the editorial team respond to it?
Yeah. I think it was very easy to publish it. I mean, I don't think it took me quite as much time as for the H2 paper to be willing to let it out.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I had Corey and Aaron Cooperman and other people read the paper, and so I don't really remember how long I took, but it certainly was nothing like for the H2 paper, and it certainly happens that things go more quickly, but even though I want to be very sure that it's correct, then
you and Aaron Cooperman taught each other as office mates, different things that you were each had expertise in.
Right.
How did those interactions help play out in your later career?
Well, he was mainly an experimentalist, and she was also a good theorist. He got me very interested in chemical reactions, understanding them, and it was basically one of the next directions that I won't say I left magnetic resonance, but when I went to Columbia, I started working on trying to look at chemical reactions, and that's when I did this H plus H2 problem with Dick Porter. And I couldn't have done it at, I thought about it at Illinois, but I couldn't have done it because the computing machinery that this ILIAC, just wasn't good enough compared to an IBM 650, which they had at the Columbia Watson Lab, where one could do the calculation. That's where we, yeah.
So when you left Illinois and went to Columbia in 1960, was computing power a big drive for you? Were you searching for access to
power? Well, it was certainly one part of it, and it was also that I sort of decided 5 years in one place was enough, and that I should go to another place to get exposed to other problems. Because certainly one of the things is that, in terms of trying to do a theory that's useful, it's good to be with other people who do different things and such. And so that was also the impetus for that. But having access to the 650 at the IBM Watson Lab was important, though, again, it was an accident that I got the offer. I was with Ben Daly. I was serving on a summer NSF program for teachers, giving lectures. And we were standing in the washroom, and he asked me, would I be interested in coming to Columbia? And I said, well, it's an interesting possibility. And at that time, I wasn't really aware of the Watson Lab. But then the offer I got was actually a position at the Watson Laboratory and some sort of adjunct professorship at Columbia. At first, I said I wouldn't accept that. That I already had tenure. I was an associate professor with tenure at Illinois, and I said I wouldn't go anywhere where I didn't have tenure. And I said I was willing to work at the Watson Lab for a while because it had all these facilities and had some very good people there, actually, who were interested both in magnetic resonance and some in reactions. But that I wanted to have a permanent position reserved for me at Columbia. I also was paid more being going to the Watson Lab. And so they finally arranged that, and I stayed at the Watson Lab for a number of years. And it was very productive. But at a certain stage, IBM started sort of saying, well, you're doing all these interesting things, but what good is it to us? And they wanted me to go up to the IBM Watson Laboratories in wherever it is outside of New York and sort of start consulting. And at that time, I told Columbia, look, I want to give up my Watson Lab position and just be a regular professor at Columbia. I also had to do less teaching when I was at the Watson Lab. And fortunately, that all worked out fine. And, often I tell my students that, working in industry, when you go there, it's great. And you don't have to worry about getting grants or anything, and they may have laboratories where you appear to be completely free to do what you want, but you never know. And so you should really go with your eyes open that this nice environment, high salary and everything else might not last. But certainly true in my case.
How is the Watson Lab structured? Did you go in and have a laboratory and, you get to hire staff? Were you put in someone else's laboratory and you had to report to a specific manager? How did it function for you?
Oh, it functions sort of like being an assistant professor at university. I mean, I had space and was given machine time and did what I wanted. And I wasn't really, I reported to the head of the Watson Lab, who was open-minded person. Again, his name escapes me for the moment. It's in there, yeah.
All right, so, I mean, it sounds like the Watson Lab in some ways wasn't a traditional, what we might think of a traditional corporate lab.
Absolutely.
It was more of a hybridized version of an academic and corporate space.
Right, okay. And some of the people there, like Dick Garwin, did a lot of consulting for, he was sort of partially the head, and was one of the people who sort of started urging me to consult the way he did. He also did things on his own. But most of the people there, like Seymour Koenig and Thomas, just did their own research up to a certain point, and then most of Al Redfield, who was in American Renaissance, at a certain point, all of them left. Except Garwin, I guess, who was so much involved in corporate structure anyway. But for the rest of the people, over a time period which started before, and why IBM did this, I guess, I think partly it was for sort of the reputation of having a laboratory with all these famous people, and partly it hoped to get some sort of consulting without really being, but it was a very unusual lab.
What was your resistance to the consultation? Why not do some more of the consulting? What was your reason
for
that?
I thought that's not what I was there for. I mean, my interest was not the business, but to do research. And I guess partly it's out of principle, and and I think that's something, again, that when you do something or when you apply to an agency for support, you really should be careful that what you're interested in is really what their interest is, For example, I mean, the DOE, it was actually the Atomic Energy Commission at the time, said they were very interested in some work I was doing on reaction kinetics, actually, and said, look, you have NSF grants, but we will take them over. You have to do less, write-ups and all this and make it very simpler. And I said, okay. And for several years, this was a great relationship. And then they decided, well, they weren't interested anymore. I mean, that this wasn't playing any role in the use of atomic energy, what I was doing. So they said they weren't interested in supporting me. And fortunately, they were very helpful, and I got back my NSF grant. But it was really, that was another lesson that I guess I hadn't learned, and it worked out okay for me, but it's something, I mean, I think you want, a university, it's sort of slightly odd. I mean, if you want to be a salaried member of the department here, you get paid actually for teaching, and however, you'd never get a job or never be promoted here if you didn't do outstanding research. And teaching graduate students and postdoctoral fellows sort of doesn't count. And so it is a slightly odd system. You would think that, if you were just doing research and educating graduate students, postdoctoral fellows, which actually takes much more of your time than giving your courses, somehow would be figured in terms of whether or not you get paid by Harvard. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I said, look, I'm going to spend part time in Europe, you know, so I taught half time for a while. And with, you know, my salary, I mean, I could still take the rest of my salary from grants, but as far as Harvard was concerned, all the rest that I was doing, publishing all these papers, doesn't count. It's sort of a slightly odd, inconsistent system, but one lives with it. Mm. And
the individuals at the Watson Lab, did they also have joint appointments at Columbia?
None of them had. Some of them had adjunct appointments,
okay,
but none of them had. This was my idea, and it took a while.
Okay. So during the period of time that you were at the Watson Lab, how much of your time was spent at that lab, and how much of your time was spent at Columbia?
Yeah, the one point is they're within 10-minute walking distance.
Mm-hmm.
So, and initially, I guess, I believe all the people who were working with me, all the postdoctoral fellows were at the Watson Lab,
mm-hmm,
and all the graduate students were at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sort of go back and each day I would probably go back and forth half a dozen times.
I mean, that's part of what I was curious about, how you would be managing your time at two different institutions that had different needs and different wants. I know you had some freedom initially at the Watson Lab, but I'm assuming you had lab space at Columbia as well.
It was just, you know, lab space like here. I mean, it was
right
room where I had, yeah.
And you have colleagues at the Watson Lab, you have colleagues at Columbia. So I'm just curious to know, I guess, a bit more about how you were able to manage those two different lifestyles simultaneously. And I think you mentioned a little bit that you were going back and forth, you know, 12 times a day. Six times a day.
Which probably is an exaggeration too.
But
depended on the day, but if I was teaching,
right,
then I taught half time while I was at the Watson Lab.
Right. But it seems like a complicated situation to try to manage two different labs at the same time.
Well, it really wasn't. I mean, it was because, you know, I mean, the Watson Lab, as long as it was there, required nothing of me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would just be using their computing machinery, talk with people once in a while, maybe give a seminar or attend a seminar if they were interested. But it was almost, if, you know, like here somebody, like we have chemistry professors that are also at the medical school, and they have labs at both places.
Mm-hmm.
Some have lab one or the other. I mean, they're very, and or people are in chemistry and physics here. But, I mean, in general, they sort of have more one than the other. But they're really, I mean, sort of what you're, I don't think what you're thinking of, sort of managing something, was. It was just, if somebody has lab space, like in chemistry, they may have a few labs here and a few labs there, and probably takes them 10 minutes to go from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So, there wasn't, and that was true. And as long as I stayed at the Watson Lab, when things sort of began to change, and it was, you know, in the wind that IBM maybe wasn't doing quite as well and sort of was not interested in some ways at keeping the Watson Lab, and finally it closed.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that happened is that Columbia got a reasonable computer, and so that I could do the computations there rather than depending on the Watson Lab. And when I first came to Harvard, actually, Harvard had a terrible system that you had to pay a huge amount for computer time. And Columbia, for a while, let me use their computer, which was essentially free. It had been a gift from Watson, Mr. Watson. I mean, Watson had a close connection with Columbia, and that way they actually were the student there. And that also probably played a role in the Watson Lab, that he really, you know, was very much, and they got a, you know, IBM, I don't remember what the number is, it's written down somewhere, computer, so we used that. And as I say, when I came here, they very kindly allowed me to use it for a while because the Harvard system was terrible.
Mm-hmm. Were you still writing your own programs?
I wrote my, initially I wrote the programs. As time went on, the students essentially wrote the programs, and I sort of, you know, looked at them and tried to find, you know, as I mentioned earlier, sort of find out whether they are right or not, but not really check. No, but I would say that 90% of the programs in days nowadays are written by the students.
Yeah.
And they're much better at it than I am, there's no question.
Yeah. I'm wondering if it's social life in New York City, coming from Champaign-Urbana in the middle of farmland Illinois to the East Coast metropolis. What was that experience like?
Well, it was wonderful. I mean, to have able to go down to Greenwich Village and, you know, watch. I mean, there are lots of things in New York that are very inexpensive. There are also things in New York that are very expensive. But
what were the things that you liked to do? Early 60s New York, just a lot of
dynamism. Go to theater. I mean, it was very, you know, nowadays theater can be very expensive. Like the Hamilton musical.
Yeah.
If you want to get a ticket there, well, we actually have tickets because we're going down. My son is in New York, and his birthday is February 28th, and mine is March 15th. So we're going down this weekend, and we managed to get tickets for Hamilton, not cheaply, but not out of this world.
That's a feat.
Yeah. And so, you know, I really have always been very fond of the theater, wherever, and that's one of the great attractions of London, which has probably the best theater in the world. And so go to theater a lot, go to music in the village, go to restaurants, and I mean, it's, you know, we didn't have no children at first, was married, but and so it's a great place to be when you have children, I think, and what schools you send becomes much more complicated.
When did you meet Susan?
When did I meet Susan? I met Susan in here at Harvard one summer. Horrible, I don't really remember the date. But
well, when did you get married?
Get married. I was in 61, I guess it was after I was at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I was back at Harvard, and she was an undergraduate at Harvard, and I met her in the library, and she helped there with some problem or other. And, yeah.
Well, that's great. So you moved in together in New York City.
Right. Yeah.
Where in New York did you live?
Well, we were very lucky that I was looking around for an apartment within walking distance. That's another sort of thing that I've always required, that I can walk to work. We can walk here in Strasbourg, Illinois, and Columbia. And, you know, I was visiting apartment buildings looking for a place to live. And on 110th near Riverside Drive, it was an apartment building, and it turned out they had a 13th floor, and people didn't like to live on the 13th floor. And so, you know, normally these apartments, this one had a beautiful view over Riverside Drive, the George Washington Bridge, and everything. Maybe a picture in there, but that would have been gone. But they had a hard time renting it, so I went there and I rented it, and it was great. It was a nice apartment. I mean, it had two bedrooms, and actually after I left, I passed it on to some. It stayed in the hands of young Columbia faculty for quite a few years, and It was just it was the 13th floor.
That's great.
So I'm trying to be, let me pause this.